a very powerful microphone. A little scary for me. Okay. Good morning. It's good to be back here. Thank you again for having me back. And a belated happy Tu B'Shvat, since I see we have the fruit here. Incidentally, my program, the Yeshiva University Targum Tzion Beit Midrash, is based in a high school, so I had a chance to ask the students the other day what Tu B'Shvat actually is. What does that mean when we have a holiday for the trees? And I don't think it reflects poorly on their education, but they were stumped. What exactly makes Tu B'Shvat a holiday? I mean, saying it's a birthday for the trees is a little bit odd. We don't have in Judaism a birthday for the elephants or, you know. Like, what does that mean that it's a birthday for the trees? Anyone know? It's the fruit that they bear. You know that in Israel right now there's a snowstorm. Well, parts of the country have a snowstorm, parts of a rainstorm. And there's no fruit being born at this time of year. I heard Chinese New Year somewhere. Sorry.
How about in Israel?
No, in Israel, I'm saying. The weather, the fruit's not coming out now. No.
But there are symptoms of almond trees that we always relate to.
Right, so we talk about the blossoms of the almond trees as being the first to emerge, but also not in January.
Usually in February. I mean, it's been most
years. Right. So the truth is that because you work with a lunar calendar rather than a solar, well, it's really lunar-solar calendar, so it's a hybrid, but you're right that it's going to be at slightly different places within the solar season within a range of 3 or 4 weeks. This year is going to be a leap year, pushing it forward, so that next year it'll be about a few weeks later on the calendar. But really, that's not what Tu B'Shvat is. Yeah.
It's a holiday. Just...
This is a very Canadian view of Tu B'Shvat. It's a holiday for the sake of a holiday. We need something, we need something in February, so we're going to call it Family Day. We need something in the beginning of August, so we're going to call it Civic Holiday. I'm American, and I don't get it. We have to have, of course there are many things that you don't get in America. I know Donald Trump being first, but it's terrible. The Tu B'Shvat actually on the Jewish calendar is the equivalent of January 1st on the financial calendar, in the sense that there is a mitzvah of tithing, separating gifts from one's produce grown in Israel, and giving it, part goes to the Kohen, the priest who works in the temple, part of it goes to the needy, part of it is brought to Jerusalem to be eaten there, various tithes. And the rule is that each year's produce has to be tithed independently. In the same way that for our taxes, all the income from January 1 to December 31 is taxed as one group, and then next year's is taxed as a separate group. So too when it comes to produce, if I have, let's say, apples that grew 1 year, I can't separate my tithe from apples that grew in a different year. And the cutoff date, in terms of when 1 year's produce ends and the next year's produce begins, is with fruit that begins the ripening process after Tu B'Shvat. That's the cutoff date. That's what makes this day a special day. It's the end of the financial year, essentially, for tithing. That's what makes it into a holiday. Why in the world Tu B'Shvat? So that's subject to some debate. It has to do with the end of the year's rainfall and at what point there's sort of a turnover in the rainfall for the next year. But I don't want to get that far afield into it. But that's what Tu B'Shvat actually is about. And it's really a celebration about the tithe for the gifts themselves. The fact that we're giving to the people who are in need from our produce is what's being celebrated on Tu B'Shvat. Okay. In any case, that brings us to our topic for this morning. Well, it doesn't bring us anywhere near our topic for this morning. Nonetheless, if you have the sheets in front of you, the topic for this morning is the Jew and the Nibbuk. This is one of those where there's a whole collection of topics where strange ideas seem to have made it into Judaism. And the question is why and how Jews have adopted them. What association they actually have with Judaism. Is it something that can be considered part of Judaism at all? And Dybbuk is definitely top of the list. What is a Dybbuk?
A devil?
A spirit. That's closer, right? Is he spirit? What does the spirit do?
Bad things.
No, what does this Dybbuk do?
It inhabits
a person. It takes over somebody's body. That is what a Dybbuk is. Is this a Jewish concept? The idea of a soul, a spirit from one person, possessing essentially another person. Jewish or not Jewish? I see a lot of no's. Right? It has become something Jewish? Maybe. I mean, there are plays about this. It's something that made it into Yiddish literature, that's for sure. So what I want to do is discuss this concept of a Dybbuk, because the Dybbuk does not appear in traditional Jewish sources. You won't find a biblical verse associated with Dybbuks. You will not find any passages in the Talmud that discuss a Dybbuk. It's just not there. At the same time, we will also see historical sources that show that as of a couple of thousand years ago, Jews were known for involvement with Dybbuks and with exercising Dybbuks. This is actually something that people associated with Jews. And so the question is, where is the link to Judaism? How is it that Jews who believed in a Dybbuk reconciled it with our faith? The word Dybbuk itself comes from what? Anybody know? It's one of those Yiddishisms that comes from Hebrew. Yeah. How do you say glue or paste in Hebrew? Exactly. Good. Dybbuk. Right? Kids learning in kindergarten now, so they have the paste and the glue, and there's a label on it that says Dybbuk. Dybbuk is, I've got a word, I will use it. Dybbuk is the term for paste or glue, something that sticks to something else. Dybbuk is the act of clinging to something, adhering to something. And so a Dybbuk is a being that adheres to somebody. It possesses, in fact, someone. That's where the word comes from. So it has a Hebrew word. It has a Hebrew name. And now I'm going to show you that actually has a stark association with Jews. If you take a look at source number two. Source number two comes from Josephus. Who was Josephus? Historian? Not really. He ended up being a historian by accident. He was a Jew. He was a leader of Jewish forces in the rebellion against Rome, going back to the first century Common Era. He was a military man. He was also the last survivor of his fortress when they were fighting against the Romans, captured by the Romans, and he wrote out a history of the Jews. He wrote several works. But it was intended to present Jews and Judaism in a way that Romans would appreciate. He was trying to ingratiate himself to the Romans and hopefully show Judaism to be something that would be not quite so foreign to them. There's reason to suspect some of the things he writes as a result, because he's trying to play to the Romans. He wants them to like him. His status among Jews is also a little bit dicey, because the story of how exactly he ended up being the sole survivor of his fortress, there are some stories about this. I don't know if anyone here has ever heard of the mathematical term, the Josephus problem, or the Josephus algorithm. You're familiar with the story of Masada, right? What happens to the Jews at Masada? They kill themselves rather than be caught by the Romans. The story goes that that was actually what they did in Josephus's fortress. But the way they did it was they had to figure out who was going to kill whom. And so they came up with a formula. And this is the formula. If you imagine people sitting in a circle. There are more people than that, but that's about my max for squares. They're sitting around in a circle, and the formula is that each person is going to kill the person not immediately to his left, but let's say skipping. They come up with a system so that each person will be responsible to kill the next. That's how they're going to manage it. And it's supposed to be impersonal, because it's done by an algorithm. It's done by a mathematical formula. The problem is that no matter how you do it, one is left. Josephus happens to be both the head of the fortress and the last man standing. And so the story goes that Josephus intended to survive, and that he rigged it so that he would be the last one there. And the Josephus problem is a problem in math, and I came across it in my computer science studies. Can you figure out how to design an algorithm such that no matter how many people are sitting in the circle, you will end up being the last one? It's a problem which is found in secular literature. Now, I learned about it at New York University. It wasn't a Jewish thing, but nonetheless, that's what it's called, the Josephus problem or the Josephus algorithm. I gave you a number 3, I gave you a link. If you want to see it online, you can learn all about the story. In any case, in number 2, we get this quote from Josephus from his Antiquities of the Jews. This is not the original Greek, in case you're wondering. God also enabled him, he's talking about King Solomon, the wisdom of Solomon. God also enabled him to learn that skill which expels demons, which is a science useful and sanative to men. He composed such incantations also by which distempers are alleviated. And he left behind him the manner of using exorcisms, by which they drive away demons so that they never return. And this method of cure is of great force unto this day. For I have seen a certain man of my own country whose name was Elazar, releasing people that were, I'm not sure how to pronounce this one, demoniacal, in the presence of Vespasian, and his sons, and his captains, and the whole multitude of his soldiers, Vespasian being a Roman general. The matter of the cure was this. He put a ring that had a foot of one of those swords mentioned by Solomon to the nostrils of the, I don't know what, demoniac, after which he drew out the demon through his nostrils. And when the man fell down immediately, he abjured him to return to him no more, making still mention of Solomon and reciting the incantations which he composed. And when Elazar would persuade and demonstrate to the spectators that he had such a power, he set a little way off a cup or basin full of water and commanded the demon as he went out of the man to overturn it, and thereby to let the spectators know that he had left the man. Oh boy. Now, the truth of the matter is that the Talmud, again, we're going back a couple of thousand years, does associate King Solomon with mystical powers. The wisdom of Solomon is not only in terms of being able to adjudicate cases. The classic story where the baby is brought before him and he has to decide who the real mother is, but he's supposed to have knowledge of mystical realms. Nonetheless, what Josephus is reporting here could not be called traditionally Jewish, except by dint of the fact that he's writing this in the first century Common Era. That makes it somehow part of the history of Judaism. This idea that there could be such a thing as a demonic possession and the idea of exorcism. Now, what he hasn't done is quite to frame it in terms of a divok, because he's talking demons. The divok is the soul of another human being. In other words, somebody died, and then their soul went into somebody else. So it's not quite the same thing. But the idea of demonic possession and exorcism is found in this very old text. Take a look at source number 4, please. This is from Bishop Oregon. He's writing a book against Celsus, who was an opponent of early Christianity. And look what he writes. The Jews trace their genealogy back to the three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the names of these individuals possess such efficacy when united with the name of God, that not only do those belonging to the nation employ in their prayers to God and in the exorcising of demons, the words God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob, But so also do almost all those who occupy themselves with incantations and magical rites. For there is found in treatises on magic in many countries such an invocation of God and assumption of the divine name as implies a familiar use of it by these men in their dealings with demons. Part of the exorcism ritual, I have to admit, I don't like horror movies, so I haven't seen any of those movies where they have exorcisms in them. But he's saying that part of the text of the exorcism is to invoke God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob. That's what he says, Bishop Oregon, 3rd century. It doesn't mean it's true, but it means that people are saying it. Now, the idea of the Divok is not exclusively found within Judaism, or the idea of possession is not exclusively found in Judaism at that time. You take a look at source number 5, which is from the abstract of a paper called Demons in Ancient Egypt, which says, while much has been written on the topic of deities and the dead in ancient Egypt, the systematic study of demons has only recently come to the fore of scholarly studies. Preliminary typologies based on surviving spells, prescriptions, and apotropaic devices, footward, suggest the theory that these hostile entities were divided into subtypes in the Egyptian worldview, distinguished from each other by the specific illnesses and conditions they caused, and as well by the prescribed means of repulsion and protection. They had various kinds of demons, which would cause different results when they possessed a person. Along with hostile demons, a related category of benevolent genii can be discerned. This paper presents an overview of demons and genii in pharaonic Egypt based primarily on sources from the Middle Kingdom through the New Kingdom. So what we find is that, again, demons, possession, and so forth are not exclusively a Jewish idea in the ancient world. You have them in Egypt as well. I'll go one step further. There was also a concept of harmful spirits, which were not necessarily beings that would possess somebody, but simply beings that would cause harm. If you take a look at source number 6, this comes from Rabbi Moses Maimonides' Rambam. He is writing much later. Right? Maimonides is, you're talking now about the 12th century Common Era. But he says, regarding people who believe in such things, these are the people who wrote books on rules of the stars and magic and invocations and spiritual zodiacs and planets and demons and fortune telling and witchcraft and superstition and seances and many similar things, against which the true Torah has unsheathed its sword and eradicated them. Those types of things are the essence of idolatry. Maimonides was not a fan. Maimonides argued that the Torah is against all of these kinds of beliefs. He noted that the biblical text says has various prohibitions against calculating omens, against trying to speak to the dead, and so forth. And so Maimonides' argument is that we're not supposed to believe in such things. Nonetheless, the very fact that someone needs to describe it and say we don't believe it tells you what? It's out there. There are people who do. Because if there weren't people who did, you wouldn't need to say, don't do it. So, where exactly does this idea fit into Judaism? So the truth of the matter is that the ideal way to approach this would first be to have a session on what the soul is within Judaism. So I may do that backwards. Maybe the next time out we'll discuss the soul. But in a nutshell, there is a clear concept of the soul found in Jewish literature. What's the first place we find the appearance of the soul in the Torah? Goes back at the very beginning, right? God forms Adam, dirt from the ground, the barman ha'adama, v'yipach ve'apav nishmat chayim, he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The word nishama, which is the word that we use for soul, is associated with nishima, a breath. And that's the first time we find the idea of a soul, certainly not the last. But the idea of the soul is that it is a creation that is separate from the body, and it animates the body. It brings the body to life. What else it is, what other properties it has, would be a good discussion for us to have maybe next time. But that's the concept of the soul in and of itself. The soul enters the body in the beginning. What happens at the end? Good question. So the truth of the matter is that, like any good topic for which you can't prove anything, there are multiple views. We have multiple views on things you can prove. But there are multiple views. It is fairly clear within the Torah that there is a belief that something happens, that, so to speak, people survive their own death. Take a look, please, at source number 7, one passage from the Torah, from the book of Deuteronomy. One of the prohibitions against various forms of magic, actually, and it says, "There shall not be found among you one who passes his son or daughter through fire." That was a practice in the Canaanite tribes that the Jews encountered when they came into the land, if anyone is familiar with the word Molech. So Molech was a type of idolatry where they would actually pass their firstborn through fire. There's some debate among the historians as to whether it was into a fire or just between two fires as part of a literally rite of passage. But that's one of the things the Torah is prohibiting. Or one who engages in sorcery, or calculates times, meaning trying to say this time of day is auspicious for a particular type of behavior, or uses omens or magic, or one who practices charms, meaning trying to charm animals, snakes, that kind of thing, or inquires of Ov or Yidoni. These, the Ov and the Yidoni, were people who would make use of animal bones and the like to try to tell someone's fortune, or one who speaks, who seeks the dead, Doresh El Hamitim. The biblical text is saying one is not supposed to try to engage in a conversation with the dead. Mind you, a monologue is fine. In other words, someone who says, "I want to speak to somebody, it makes me feel good to talk to somebody," and they go to the cemetery and they want to stand there and speak to the person who's buried there, that's not our problem. Our problem is when you're looking for an answer. When you try to make it into a conversation, that's the problem. That's what we call Doresh El Hamitim, seeking the dead. Seances, that kind of a thing. So, the biblical text is saying, we don't do that. However, by banning this, what is the Torah also saying about such things? Sorry?
You're banning it, it's there.
It's there, exactly. It's saying there is such a thing. Now, mind you, Maimonides disagrees with this. Maimonides comes out and says that the reason the Torah is not letting you do this is because you're not supposed to be foolish. God made you a brain, use it. That's Maimonides' point of view. He says there's no way that you're going to get a response back. However, the vast majority of commentators stood against him and said, no, this is actually something that could be done. Because the soul survives one's death. And that's why I bring the verse here, is to show you one example of several, that the biblical text does believe that people go on after their time here. I'm going to give you another example. This one comes from later. It comes from the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel. And it's going to be important for our discussion about Dilaks. It comes from the story of King David and a woman by the name of Abigail, or Abigail. This comes from a period of time in David's career when he was a fugitive. Well, he was a fugitive multiple times, but one of the periods when he was a fugitive. His men had helped protect the herds and flocks of a man by the name of Nabal. And he expected that Nabal, in exchange, was going to support him. Nabal was not interested. David is ready to go to war against Nabal. And Abigail, comes out with supplies taken from Nabal's property to support David's people to avert this battle between her husband and David's men. As part of her speech to David, she gives David a blessing in source number 8. And she says, "If a man rises to pursue you and seek your soul," in other words, someone wants to kill him, "may my master's soul be bound in the bond of life with Hashem your God, and may the soul of your enemy be catapulted in the bowl of the catapult." So, I'm going to focus first on the first part of this, which is the one that's better known. Does a phrase here look familiar? Yeah, which one? The soul to be bound up in the bottom of the wine, right? Anybody ever go to the cemetery and see on a headstone the following letters? And I'll write it out on the board. You know where anyone's going to be talking about? The letters are Tav, Nun, Tzadi, Bet, Hey. You ever see them on a headstone, yeah? That stands for Tihyeh Nishmato Tsurah B'Tzror HaChayim. May his soul be bound up in the bond of life. It is the blessing that Abigail gave to King David. So that becomes a blessing that is offered after somebody passes away, because we take it to mean that their soul should remain part of the chain of Jewish souls. They're still part of the nation, and they go on after this world. They're not simply cut off, and they don't disappear. That's the idea. And it comes from Abigail's blessing. What about the second half of her blessing? This, may the soul of your enemy be catapulted in the bowl of the catapult. What in the world is she talking about? That's weird. I mean, certainly when I was in day school, we never learned anything about any catapults for souls. Maybe that's because they didn't want to give us ideas. But boys high school. What in the world is this about? So we're going to have to come back to this. But before we do, I wanted to show you one other story. It's source number 9, the top of the second side. This is also from the book of Shmuel, the book of Samuel. I lifted some of the verses out to make a long story short. King Saul was the king before King David. Shmuel, Samuel, was a prophet who was instructed by God to do the sort of thing you should never do in the Middle East. Not then and not now. Right? What did God tell him to do with King David? No. God tells Samuel to coronate David as the new king while Saul is still alive. Very bad idea in the Middle East. You don't want to do that. Nonetheless, that's what he's supposed to do. God has rejected Saul, and he has accepted King David, and David is going to be the new king. Saul has a very hard time with it. If you're familiar with the story, you know just how bad it gets. And at one point, after Samuel is dead, while he's still dealing with this problem with David, he says, I need advice. I need advice from the prophet. I need to go seek Samuel. But as I said, Samuel's dead. So Saul goes to a woman who is an Ov. Remember I mentioned the Ov, people who use animal bones and the like? So he goes to an Ov. Well, not just a fortune teller now, to summon the soul of Samuel. The only problem is he has previously gone on a campaign to rid the Jews of such practices, and she knows that she can get killed for this. She knows that this is, she can have all sorts of trouble come to her. And so Saul goes to her in secret, in a disguise, so she won't know who he is. This story is better known as the story of the Witch of Endor. You ever heard that? Ain Dor was the place where she lived. So this is the Witch of Ain Dor. Endor. So, and she said to him, the woman says to Saul, not knowing he's Saul, but he has made this request of calling someone up from the dead. She says, behold, you know what Saul has done, eradicating the Ovote, plural of Ove, and his own Eve from the land. Why are you causing me to stumble, to kill me? Saul, and that's what she says to him. And Saul swore to her by God, as God lives, no sin will befall you in this, you will not get into trouble. And she said, okay, who shall I raise for you? Who exactly is it that you want to talk to? Like she had yellow pages, whatever it was. She says, tell me who I'm supposed to look up. And he said, bring up Samuel for me. And she saw Samuel, and she shrieked loudly. And she said to Saul, why have you tricked me? You are Saul. What did you do to me? You're the king. And the king said to her, "Do not fear. What did you see?" And she told Saul, "I saw an angel rising from the land." And he said to her, "What did he look like?" And she said, "An elderly man rising wrapped in a cloak." And Saul knew it was Samuel, and he stretched low to the ground and bowed, and then he has a conversation with Samuel in this chapter. You can go read it in Samuel 1. I bring you this story to show you that this is another example in which the biblical text seems to believe that a soul does indeed go somewhere after this world. It doesn't simply stop when the person's body stops. It continues to go somewhere. Those who are more skeptical about it will say this was actually a dream of King Saul. It wasn't an event, but the witch for sure thought it was real. So you have a biblical concept that the soul goes somewhere. What the biblical text does not really spell out is where. So Samuel is around somewhere. The dead are around somewhere, but it doesn't say what that place looks like. It doesn't say what goes on there. It doesn't say what one does there. That we don't find really described in the biblical text other than with the vaguest of hints. You know, there are passages like returning to one's forefathers, but no one really knows what that means. So the Talmud fleshes it out by describing places of reward and places of punishment. So I gave you an example in source number 10. The Talmud takes a verse from Ecclesiastes, the book of Kohelet, which says, a person goes to the home of his world. Beit Olamo. So what does that mean? Rabbi Yitzchak explained, each righteous person receives a dwelling befitting his honor. He says, literally, there's a home that is your world. And so you get a house. Depending on who you were, depending on the kind of life you lived, you're going to get a certain type of a dwelling. It sounds like he believes a physical place, right? If there's a house, which means I have to shovel, which isn't good. But that's you know, that's what comes with being a homeowner. That's one source. Then on the other hand, you have another source. If you take a look at source number 11, from the same volume of the Talmud, the same section, the souls of the righteous are stored under the divine throne. As it is written, the soul of my master shall be bound in the bond of life. That verse sound familiar? That's the one. Excuse me, that Abigail, that Abigail said to King David, is about the soul being close to God. Much more about some kind of a spiritual place of reward as opposed to something physical. Those are the happy places. But then there's also source number 12, which says, our fire, the fire that we use in this world, was created on the first Saturday night. Meaning, if you go through the account of creation in Bereshit, in Genesis, it talks about how some things were created, but it leaves out others. One of the items that leaves out, is fire. Doesn't say when fire comes into existence. I mean, you could argue, I suppose, if you want, that since it talks about the creation of the stars, and the stars are, you know, gaseous and there's fire and so forth, maybe that's fire, also the sun. But nonetheless, what the Talmud states here is that fire is created on the first Saturday night, but there's a fire of Gehinnom. Gehinnom being the word that the Talmud uses to describe what we in English tend to call hell. That's created on the first Friday. Gehenna is created on the first Friday, right? The Hebrew Gehinnom is from a place that's described in the prophets, a place of idolatry. That's where it's actually Gehinnom is the full name that gets shortened to Gehinnom. Literally, it's the Valley of Hinnom. Has anyone been there? I don't mean the one described here. The physical location, the valley. You can go there. I mean, it's outside Jerusalem. There are tours. Boy, that's pretty funny. Incidentally, this passage in the Talmud about the first fire being created on the first Saturday night is the origin of what practice? As part of Havdalah, making a blessing over fire. Right? There are fundamentally four blessings within Havdalah. Right? One blessing is making the distinction between Shabbat and the rest of the week. There's a blessing over wine or grape juice or whatever beverage one uses for a Havdalah in order to dignify the occasion by having a drink. There's the blessing over spices that smell good, because the person goes from Shabbat to the week, and it's supposed to be sort of a come down, and therefore make it a little easier by smelling something sweet. And then in addition, there's the blessing over fire, which has two resonances. There are two messages to it. One is, I wasn't allowed to use fire for Shabbat, now I am allowed to. And the other is this point, the idea that fire is first created on the first Saturday night. An interesting discussion in its own right, there's more we could say about that. But in terms of the latter half of source number 12, the fire of Gehinnom was created on the first Friday, and Gehinnom, or Gehenim, is supposed to be a place of punishment. So what we have right now, just to make sure that we understand where we're going with this, is we started out by showing that even though there's no biblical verse about people's souls possessing others, and there's no Talmudic passage either, if you go back to Roman times, Jews were apparently known for being involved with something to do with possession by demons and with exorcism. It wasn't only us. Egypt had it too, for example. But nonetheless, there are people who think that Jews have this. Josephus, Bishop Oregon, to them, this is normal. We then shifted from that. Well, our question is, where is that within Judaism? That's what we really want to know. So we shifted from that to talk about the soul and said that there is a belief, going back to the biblical text, that the soul goes on after a person passes away, and that the Talmud fleshes out a place of reward and a place of punishment. That still doesn't bring us to the Dybbuk, right? Because this is neither the place of reward nor the place of punishment, I would think. So there's a third possibility. And that goes back to what Abigail said. Go back to number 8, the bottom of the first side of the sheet. It speaks of the soul of your enemy being catapulted in the bowl of the catapult. And that suggests some form of limbo stage. If you take a look at source number 13 now, this is what the Talmud does with it. Regarding the bodies of the wicked, Isaiah 48 says, God declares there is no peace for the wicked. Ein shalom l'rasha'im. And regarding their souls, they quote this verse from Abigail, and may the souls of your enemies be catapulted in the bowl of the sling. One malach. What is a malach? Angels. So one malach, one angel, is at one end of the universe, and another at the other end of the universe, and they sling these souls to each other, as it is written, and so forth. Hey, like that one. Like a little lacrosse, right? They're playing catch with the soul of the wicked. Don't say your soul to me. Don't do that. Thank you. The Talmud does not go any further in describing what this is. What are we talking about when we say a limbo state? Is this supposed to be taken literally, that souls are being slingshot? So generally, it's not taken that way. One approach to this is found in source number 14. This comes from, as I wrote on the sheet, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra, a rabbi in the 15th into the 16th century for Spain and then Israel, regarding the issue of reincarnation. And he has the following question that's been put to him. The following midrash is hard for us to understand. Midrash says, similar to the one we've just read, the souls of the righteous and the souls of the wicked alike return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world. As it is written, and may the souls of your enemies be catapulted in the bowl of the sling. He says, this is the opposite of our tradition, the questioner asks. Further, the proof brought, meaning the verse, applies to the wicked one's soul. Why should the righteous one's soul be buffeted about? What is his source? The questioner is asking about reincarnation, and is saying, I've been taught that good and bad, they both come back to this world. And it's been based on this verse. But this verse seems to be talking about the wicked, the enemies of King David. It's supposed to be for bad people. What is this talking about? What is this reincarnation? Where does it come from? That's the question that's asked. And Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra answers the following. He quotes the Talmud, the passage that we just read. We find that Rabbi Eliezer said the opposite. The souls of the righteous are stored beneath the throne of glory, as it is written, the soul of my master should be bound in the bond of life. And the souls of the wicked are buffeted below, as it is written, and may the souls of your enemies, etc. However, know that there are righteous people who receive as do the wicked in this matter, such as those who stumbled in a sin which mandates reincarnation until they fulfill the divine will according to his justice. Thus it is written, he divines his plans lest anyone be pushed away. As Radbaz understands it, there is a concept of reincarnation, which is its own discussion, but he is on the side that believes that there is a Jewish idea of reincarnation that's a hot debate in its own right. And he says that God actually uses reincarnation for people who need to atone for something that happened in this world. And so he says, thus that Midrash that said that both the souls of the righteous, which need this, and the souls of the wicked return, descend, and are buffeted about in the world, hinting at what we have said. I'm not sure how much mysticism you expected when you got up this morning. But those who signed up on the sheets knew, because I emailed in advance to the people on the list. I told you what our topic was, and I sent you the sources. So you knew before you came. What we're seeing here is an explanation for the limbo concept. What he's suggesting is there are three fates that are possible after a person leaves this world. There's a place of reward, there's a place of punishment, and then there's reincarnation to make right something that was wrong in the person's life here. So that's one explanation of what this limbo is about. There's a second approach, and that's source number 15, which suggests that no, it's actually a limbo state. Take a look at number 15. This comes from Rabbi Yehuda Loew. Rabbi Yehuda Loew is probably better known to people as the Maharal of Prague. Right? With the story about creating the golem. Although he didn't create a golem that we also know. Whatever's in the attic of the Alamo Shul, it's not a golem, and he didn't make it. The story of the golem starts long after he had already passed away. I think it was a writer in Montreal, no? Who was very instrumental in this story. Rabbi Rosenberg in Montreal was responsible for popularizing it. But in any case, Rabbi Loew writes the following. The wicked person goes to extremes in his deeds. The opposite of a righteous person who does not stray from the straight path and the middle point. But he's preaching moderation. He says, righteous people act in a moderate way. A wicked person goes to extremes, he says. Therefore, a malach stands at one end of the world and another at the other end, just as he, the wicked person, went from one extreme to the other. There are two extremes. So he has no rest. For as you will know and understand with deep wisdom, the extreme has no rest. And I'm back to Trump. No. Therefore, the malach who stands at one end and does not accept him, for he is associated with the extreme. And so he slings him to the second extreme. And so forth. So what you have are the following possibilities. We have place of reward, also called Gan Eden. Place of punishment, also called Gehenna. And then we have limbo, as predicted by Abigail, which has two explanations that we've seen so far. One explanation is that limbo means reincarnation, which is going to run off the edge of the blackboard. And the other is this explanation from the Maharal of Prague, Rabbi Loew, that actually means, no, there's limbo. The person is punished for having gone to extremes by being chased from one extreme to the other in this next world. Essentially, it's a form of punishment. That's the idea. So that brings me back to the Divak. I'm going to suggest that there are two ways to fit the Divak into Jewish philosophy. Clearly, once we accept the idea that the soul goes on after this life, So we have the soul there. The question is, how did it end up in somebody else's body? What's it doing there? So one possible explanation is that it is simply under his head, the heading of punishment. That a person committed a wrong in this world, maybe that person will be sent there as a form of punishment for him, as well as punishment for the person who is receiving that person. In other words, both the host of the Nivik and the Nivik itself are being made to suffer. It sounds like a really strange idea, and I have great difficulty with it. Nonetheless, maybe that could be the suggestion. I am not the first person to suggest this. If you take a look at the last source on the sheet, source number 16, Rabbi Yaakov Chaim Sofer, a major Sephardic authority in Jewish law from the 19th century into the early 20th, dealt with this as a way to explain a certain blessing. He suggests, you know, there are blessings that are recited traditionally each morning. And one of them, thanks God, thank you for not making me a non-Jew. Thank you, God, for making me Jewish. You're familiar with the blessing. The blessing, incidentally, sorry. Yeah, that's there on the list also. You know why? So, not wanting to open a can of worms when we have like 10 minutes to go. But I never met a can of worms I didn't want to open. There are actually three blessings that are part of a set. One is thanking God for making me a Jew. One is thanking God for making me free. And one is thanking God, males will say, thank you for making me not a woman. I'm wording it in a positive for a reason. But those are the three blessings. Long before there was any such thing as feminism, and long before there was any such thing as political correctness and people getting in trouble for saying things that were foolish, the sages were already bothered by these blessings and wanted to know, so what exactly is this about? And so you find one commentary to the Talmud, written in the 12th century, but expressing a much earlier idea, saying that it's really fairly straightforward. What you're doing is thanking God for the commandments and doing it in increasing order. So in other words, I am a Jew and therefore I have commandments. I am free and therefore, as opposed to the slave, I have a greater, broader set of commandments. And the fact is that the males have more commandments than the females do. And so that's where this comes from. That's the idea. However, that's only part of the story. The other part of the story is the fact that the blessings aren't worded in the positive. Right? They're worded in the negative. Thank you for not making me a non-Jew. Thank you for not making me a slave. Thank you for the males not making me a woman. Why are they in the negative? So how many of you have read Paul's letter to the Galatians? Not on the reading list, huh? Okay. In this case, I think it's a worthwhile reading. Because if you email me after, my email address is on the sheet, I will be glad to send you out the actual text. Not often you will hear a rabbi say, I'll be glad to send you the actual text from the New Testament. Nonetheless, the text there, Paul sends out a letter saying, no longer shall there be Jew and Gentile, free man and slave, man and woman, all be equal in the eyes of God and so forth. Everybody will be the same. And at the same time, in the same generation, is when this blessing was drafted, the set of blessings were drafted. In other words, it's a response to Paul. Paul makes the statement of, no longer will there be a distinction. And so the rabbis, either Rabbi Meir or Rabbi Tarfo, there are two different editions of it, but the rabbis, you know, sit down and say, so I'm going to have them make a blessing saying, no, I specifically assert there is a difference. Thank you for not making me a non-Jew, and so forth for the entire set. Now, mind you, if I were a woman, that wouldn't make me particularly happy about the blessing and the way it's structured. And there are those who have floated the idea of wording it in the positive. It has existed in the positive in various communities over the course of history. I'm not going to get into the full discussion about this right now, but that's the origin of it. And that's a long way of coming back to where we were. Which, yeah.
It didn't exist until Paul, after Paul.
Correct. The blessings, that set of blessings isn't there. It's drafted at that point in history. So, Rabbi Sofer was bothered by a different aspect of this blessing. He wasn't particularly concerned at this stage with the contents of the blessing. He was concerned about the timing. Why are you making a blessing every single morning? Thank you for not making me this, not making me that, not making me that. Like, you make a blessing once in your life, and it's still true tomorrow. Why do you need this blessing every single day? So there are many explanations we could offer. But look at his explanation. He says, it is also possible to explain that during one's lifetime, one might become, quote, pregnant with one of these. What's he talking about? A dibbuk. What he's suggesting is that one might wake up one morning to find himself inhabited by a soul that is a non-Jew, a slave, a woman, and so forth. And the blessing is actually thanking God for not making me or giving me a dibbuk overnight. It's a remarkable suggestion. It's certainly not what I would consider the mainstream explanation of the blessing. But it highlights the possibility that there would be a way to see dibbuk within Judaism as a form of punishment. There's a punishment going on, and this soul is being inserted into the person. Alternatively, what I find to be a fancier suggestion, but it is my own, so take it for what it's worth, would be that the dibbuk was understood to be a form of limbo. In other words, once we have a biblical verse, this woman, Abigail, talking to David about the idea that the soul is not able to rest. It doesn't go to a place of reward, it doesn't go to a place of punishment, but instead it has to wander. Maybe they took that as limbo. Now let me make sure I'm being clear with this, because, you know, this stuff is strange. What I'm not trying to say that dibbuk is a core Jewish idea. As I said a couple of times, you will not find it in the biblical text, you will not find it in the Talmud. Life after death, yes. Dibbuk, no. However, what we also know is that there were Jews historically, and not only in the shtetl of Eastern Europe, but going back a couple of thousand years to Roman times, apparently, there were people who believed that somehow the concept of a soul possessing somebody could happen, that this could be consistent with Judaism. And so the question I'm asking is, how could a believing traditional Jew adopt the idea of a dibbuk when it's not found in our standard texts? And so my answer is, either they saw it as a form of punishment, like that last source that we just saw, that if God wants to zap somebody, this is apparently, you know, a weapon at his disposal. Or alternatively, they saw it as a fulfillment of this idea of limbo. Maybe they saw it as, you know, as that, and that was how the proponents of the dibbuk idea would reconcile it with Judaism. It does not mean that a Jew has to believe in the concept of a dibbuk. A person could be a believing Jew and deny it entirely. I feel pretty comfortable in that camp. Or one might be, in fact, a believing Jew and say, yeah, dibbuk is another form of punishment, and or a form of limbo, whatever approach they take. Am I being clear with that? I want to make sure that no one comes out of here saying, Torchiner said that dibbuk stuck out in the Torah. Okay, that's what I want to avoid. Yes?
I'm wondering, you're talking about the dibbuk. Is the dibbuk entering only one person, or would the dibbuk be wandering from one to another who needs the punishment?
Right. So I'm not an expert on dibbukology. Or if I'm wanting Hebrew, dibbukologia, I suppose. However, if I'm looking at this, I see no reason to restrict him to one place. Right? Meaning, once he's already in limbo, so, you know, let him wander around. Limbo's a fun game. Well, probably not for him. But yes, presumably, start here, go there, or as a punishment, the same could hold true. I see no reason for it to be restricted to one individual. Yeah?
Is a soul wicked? And if it isn't, why is it being punished?
Right. This is a very, very good question. There's a prayer that's said every morning, which says, it says, God, the soul you put into me is pure. And the assumption is that a soul remains pure. It cannot be corrupted. The deeds that a person performs layer dirt, as it's usually termed, more or less, on the person's soul. And it's not something that can corrupt what's inside, but can obscure what's inside. And so one approach to this idea of punishment, and not just divok and limbo, but general punishment, is to suggest that the person may need refining not because of what's inside, but because of what they've gone through and what they've done. That's one school of thought. Another school of thought says, it doesn't matter who the person is inside, what matters is what they do. And the person who commits crimes has to fundamentally pay the price, so to speak, and that's what's going on. But I think maybe we'll do that. Maybe the next session, closer to Purim, so I was thinking maybe we would talk about Purim. But maybe not. Maybe we'll spend the next session and talk a little bit more about soul and you know, this sort of thing. Yeah. Sounds good to me.
March 1st?
Yeah. Okay. So yes, maybe we'll have a session on this on March 1st. We'll talk soul, reward, punishment, all that. Yes?
Signs from above or go to the door.
That would have to be another session. Right. We could end up, we could end up with a series on supernatural things. It's certainly possible. Yes.
In school today, in modern Orthodox school, is there any teaching put on it, or is it totally ignored and said we're not following it?
Right. That's a very good question. Generally speaking, as you call it, the modern Orthodox world, there's a school problem. And the school problem essentially is that we have a lot of curriculum and very little time. Because unlike in a traditional yeshiva setting, where the vast bulk of the day will be spent on Jewish studies, and you can have long hours and no one's asking you why their child isn't getting to play hockey after school, you're dealing with a system in which there are very specific hours that you have to work with and an awful lot to teach. As a result, what I have found is that you don't really spend a lot of time on this sort of topic, other than sometimes in high school there will be classes devoted to just sort of asking questions and getting answers that way in a loose framework. Or a general overview of Jewish philosophy that may touch on some of this, but it isn't really, I haven't seen it as a solid part of the curriculum because there's so much else that needs to be taught. Thank you very much.